Okay, we're back in Genesis chapter 1. We're going through the Bible, picking up these passages that have reference to science and particularly to objections that people might have to seeing the Bible as the error-free Word of God from the perspective of science. Genesis is that place where we have the greatest challenge, mainly as we pointed out, because people misidentify the frame of reference for the text. It's not up here in the heavens. Rather, it's the surface of the waters, and the first day it's dark, not because there's a lack of light. God created the light in the beginning, but the atmosphere would not permit the passage of light to the surface of the waters. And the last week we finished up our discussion of the fourth day of creation, which describes the second miracle that God performed in the atmosphere, transforming it from a translucent condition where light diffuses through the atmosphere to where the atmosphere is made partially transparent, where the clouds break, and now for the first time the observer on the surface of the waters can witness and see the objects that are responsible for the light coming down. As the text tells us, it's not claiming that God created the sun, moon, and stars on the fourth day. That's what's led to the ridicule of this particular chapter of the Bible, because the third day speaks about plant life, and how can plants possibly survive without the heat and the light of the sun? And many people have misunderstood this fourth creation day as a claim that this sun did not show up until that particular time. That's not what the text says. It says, let there be lights. Uses the verb haya, let them be. Just like in the first creation day, it says, let the light appear. Now it's saying, let the great lights appear to this observer on the surface of the waters. The observer could not see the objects that are responsible for the light until this atmosphere was transformed from a translucent condition to a transparent condition. Let there be lights. Let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. The light has been there from the beginning. It's not a statement that the light was made on the fourth creation day, because after all, we have light in the very beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We also have in the first creation day, let there be light on the surface of the waters. So let's not misunderstand that statement where it says, let there be light. It's simply repeating what's already been said in the first creation day. But now we can see where the light is actually coming from. And it was so. Now we have the parenthetical phrase. As I mentioned last week, there are no parentheses in the Bible. Punctuation marks did not exist. Quotation marks didn't exist. But here's a parenthetical note. God made two great lights. The verb there is a saw, and there are three verb forms, and this is simply in the form that God made two great lights. These two great lights, the sun and the moon, were made sometime in the past. They're completed by the fourth creation day. They could have been completed any time previous to the fourth creation day. The first verse tells us they were made before the 6 days of the creation. So they were manufactured by God. God takes credit for constructing the stars. They just don't simply arise. God constructs them. He made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night, that's the moon. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. Now, once again, the light was already separated from darkness on the first creation day. This is a parenthetical note explaining what this sun, moon, and stars is all about. They were not mentioned on the fourth creation day, so it makes sense that the author here is going to pause and explain what the sun, moon, and stars is all about. It says, by the way, the day and the night that you've been observing since the first creation day, this is as a result of the light flowing from the sun. And this is what's separating the light from the day. And now that you can see these objects and their movements in the sky, you can actually mark seasons and years. It was impossible to mark seasons and years in the first three creation days. All you saw was an overcast sky. And you didn't have those time markers in the heavens to indicate months and to indicate years. Now those objects are available to mark the seasons and the years. So day and night was something that you could always mark the days, but now we couldn't. But now you can mark both weeks and months and years. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, there was morning, the fourth day. Now, The one thing I didn't get to last week in a rush to finish the discussion of the fourth creation day, notice that the text speaks about the existence of stars early in the text. Okay, so stars are mentioned here in the fourth creation day. Stars must have existed even before the 6 days of creation. Why that's going to prove important? When we get to the third chapter of Genesis, we're going to run into another controversy that's been splitting the Christian church and causing an apologetic problem in the light of non-Christians. And this is the doctrine coming from certain segments of the Christian community, promoting the view that when Adam and Eve fell into sin, when they rebelled against the authority of God, that's when the laws of thermodynamics first came into existence. In other words, there's this interpretation that thermodynamics is not good. The laws of thermodynamics tell us that things tend towards decay rather than order, and decay isn't good. If you ever cleaned a house, you kind of recognize that it's a bit of a bother to deal with the decay that accumulates, all right? So decay can't be good. From our perspective, it's not a good thing. We have to work to deal with that decay. And so the tendency is to blame this decay on human beings rather than upon God himself. And so they said, well, Adam is the one that did it all. We can blame all this decay that's going on in the universe on Adam. Not God, but Adam. Now, that doesn't really get them off the doctrinal hook, because the Bible tells us that God is sovereign. He is in control of everything. And, if Adam was the one responsible, well, who permitted Adam to be responsible? God's still the one in authority, in control. He's the one that's sovereign. But the doctrinal motivation here is, since decay is not good, then, and God is good, God can't be the author of this decay. It must be either Satan or Adam, and maybe the two of them can be blamed. Now, here's Satan coming down, deceiving Eve. Eve gets Adam to go along with the deception. And so those are the guilty parties, rather than God himself. Now, we can refute that from Genesis chapter 1, easily, because it talks about stars. Now, the reason why stars works as a refutation of this idea that thermodynamics can be blamed on Adam, there's really very few examples that we can find in physics that would be a clear demonstration of the second law of thermodynamics in stars. The only better examples I can think of would be the universe itself. Now, stars, the universe, are perfect examples of this process of the second law of thermodynamics, near perfect examples, as perfect as we can find. I mean, it's really the best example of the proficiency for the tendency towards decay. What is that second law of thermodynamics based on? It's talking about the flow of heat from hot bodies to cold bodies, and that's why decay is the basis of the second law of thermodynamics. It's the heat flowing from hot bodies to cold bodies that causes things to go from order to disorder. So fundamentally, that's what the second law of thermodynamics is all about. And what better example do we have of heat flow from hot bodies to cold bodies than stars? I mean, stars are 17 billion degrees centigrade, and they're warming up space, which is only 3 degrees above absolute zero. So, and they're very efficient in pouring out this heat and light from a source at 17 billion degrees to something that's virtually absolute zero. And this has been going on since the beginning, even before the 6 days of creation. This has been taking place. And it's been taking place at the same rate. And so there's no basis for this theory that the Genesis 3 is a start to thermodynamics. Genesis 1 tells us that the thermodynamics has been with us since God created the universe itself. Thermodynamics begins with the Big Bang. Now, you can extend that. Stars have a specific entropy measure of a little less than 100,000, supernova of a million, the universe itself of 1 billion. A burning candle would have a specific entropy of 2. So, that's typically what we think of as something that's extremely entropic. A candle is really only good for radiating heat and light to its environment. But it's rather a poor example of the second law of thermodynamics compared to stars. And there's really no way that you could build a star without the second law of thermodynamics. If you got stars, you got the second law of thermodynamics. Now the problem is not everybody within the Christian community understands how beautiful stars are exemplifying the second law of thermodynamics, that they're really equivalent. Got stars, you got the second law. There's really no denying it. The text might as well say right here in the verse 15 and 16, the second law of thermodynamics is operating from this point onward, is operating backwards to before the 6 days of creation. So we can do away with that interpretation of Scripture. And I mentioned that we get to the third creation day. This does rank as a very divisive issue. Our own organization, Reasons to Believe, is attacked by significant members of the Christian community for holding onto this heretical view that thermodynamics exists even in the early verses of Genesis 1. But, you know anything about the physics of stars? How can you deny it? And the text tells us right here in black and white, stars are there. They're present. Can't deny it. There's a hand over here. Yes, Ted. That's exactly my point. Decay is present before Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden, simply because we have stars burning. The heat flow from hot bodies to cold bodies is going to bring about the condition of order progressing towards disorder. It's going to happen. Now, in order to really deal with this segment of the Christian community, you just can't stop there. You know, if you stop there, you know what's going to happen? There's going to be an emotional turmoil. Well, what you're telling me then is that according to Genesis 1, God is cruel and God is spiteful. No, we got to deal with one more issue. Who says the second law of thermodynamics is bad? It's our human interpretation which looks upon that second law of thermodynamics and equates it with evil and cruelty. My reply would be, there's nothing evil or cruel about that second law of thermodynamics. In fact, life isn't even possible in this universe without the second law of thermodynamics. What you need to do is move from stars to the human stomach, okay? We are a living organism. The reason why we're able to do any work at all is that we're taking advantage of that second law of thermodynamics. The flowing of heat from hot bodies to cold bodies enables us to draw work from that heat flow so that we can move around. And if you can't move, then life is not possible. One of the definitions for life is that it has the capacity to reproduce and the capacity to draw energy from its environment perform work. And work is not going to be possible unless that second law of thermodynamics is in effect. In fact, what you discover is that you need a certain efficiency of heat flow from hot bodies to cold bodies to get a certain degree of work possible. You know, if you've been through the engineering and physics classes, they introduce you to something called the Carnot engine. And what the Carnot engine is all about, you measure the temperature of the hot body, you measure the temperature of the cold body, where the heat's flowing from the hot body to the cold body, and the differences in those two temperatures determines how much work can be done by an engine taking advantage of that heat flow. Well, the same thing applies to us. What we do is we consume food, and that food is burnt, and there's a temperature difference between that and the waste products of that food. It's a few degrees in the human body, and that few degrees is enough that we can perform a certain modicum of work. Now, if it were several tens of degrees, that temperature difference would kill us. The way our stomachs and digestion of food is determined is that the temperature differences are only a few degrees. That's why you got to eat so much more food than your car. Okay? You ever been amazed by that? Look how far your car goes on a gallon of gasoline. Now, for you to do the same amount of work, how many hamburgers would you have to eat? Okay, I mean, that would be a good homework assignment. All right, very good, Tom. Figure out how much your car weighs, how fast it goes, how much horsepower you need to make all that happen, and then how many hamburgers you got to eat to get the same output of work as that car does, and compare that and compare that with a gallon of gasoline, and then figure out how many dollars you'd have to spend. This will give you a whole lot more appreciation for your automobile. I mean, for a buck, look what all the work you get to do. Figure out how much money you got to spend to do that own work by your own human effort. Okay, I would guess it's at least 1,000 to 1 difference. You have to spend 1,000 times as much money to get the same amount of work out. But again, what this all tells us is that thermodynamics is not bad for us. Thermodynamics is good for us. It's because of thermodynamics that we can live and survive and perform the will of God. And if you lose your ability to take advantage of the second law of thermodynamics, you lose your ability literally to minister. So it's not something that's cruel or evil. It's a good gift. God gave it to us, a beautiful gift, so that we can perform God's functions in this universe. Now, in the new universe that we will one day inherit, there will be no thermodynamics. You can check it out by reading. We're going to eventually get there, by the way. We're not going to be spending as much time on several chapters of the Bible as we're spending on Genesis 1. So don't think of this, my gosh, we're going to be here for hundreds of years getting through the Bible. No, we'll eventually get you to Revelation 21 and 22. But what you'll discover there is that there's no gravity, there's no electromagnetism, there's no thermodynamics. God replaces it with different kinds of physics. But it's only possible because God has already dealt with evil and suffering. And therefore, there's no need for those physical laws, and he can replace them with other laws. So, now there was a hand. Yes.
Star placement. Is there anything in the Bible about that? Why there's constellations, various things, patterns.
Okay. Yeah, we did a TV thing on that one, too, because that's another problem in the Christian community. There's been 4 books that I know of that have been written by Christians trying to make the claim that the constellations are a fifth gospel, that the message of what Jesus did here on earth and his plan of salvation is revealed to us in the constellations. There is no truth to that at all. What's happening is that certain Christians are reading into constellation patterns what they want to see. And incidentally, when you look into Greek and Egyptian mythology and astrology, they did exactly the same thing. I mean, they looked at the star patterns and read into that the theology that they wanted to preach. And the point we make in that documentary is that you could weave any story you want into the star patterns. Invent a story, then look up in the sky and see what you can get to fit. And as proof of that, look at the star patterns. Okay, look at the Greek myths and the astrology they built out of that, and then say, well, all right, they claim that this is a guy that's shooting an arrow. Boy, those stars, you really have to use your imagination to see that in those stars. And you look at Cassiopeia, that's supposed to be a female goddess sitting on her throne. Well, you look up there and all you see is a W shape. And you say, well, how did they ever figure out that there was a woman sitting on a throne there? The stars do not testify to any kind of theological story. You got to read it into those things, like looking at the clouds. You ever did that as a kid, kind of lie down, look up the clouds and say, wow, I see a horse or whatever? It's the same kind of thing. Well, that's what happened. These authors were looking up there and said, well, that's the Virgin Mary and there's Joseph up there and, you know, here. I mean, they read the whole gospel story into it, but it was eisegesis rather than exegesis going on in that case. Does that answer your question? Okay. Anyway, a lot of what we have to do here in science and the Bible is deal with all the rumors and myths and misconceptions, as well as what's really going on. and to realize that our interpretations are up for grabs and refinement. Okay, but I did want to add that one point there, that the mention of stars here in the text is clear proof that thermodynamics was going on much before the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. Okay, moving into the fifth creation day. One other thing I can share with you. This just got published on Friday. As we were discussing this in the third creation day, let's see if we can pop that up here. Formation of land masses. For the first time, we now can give you a date as to when the formation of the land masses took place. This article got published in Science. It's called The Early Evolution of the Continents. And what they were able to do is use the element niobium relative to uranium, and the fact that it's about six times more prevalent in continental crusts compared to oceanic crust, and even more prevalent than it is in the residual mantle. And by looking at ancient rocks, they were able to determine how much of the Earth's crust was continental compared to oceanic at different times in history. The answer that comes out of this, and this fits in beautifully what we're seeing here in Genesis 1, it describes this event as being the third creation day, when the land masses pop up above the universal ocean and gradually form these continents. What they've discovered is that if you go back 4 billion years, there are no continents, there are no islands. At 2.7 billion years, the continental land masses are about as prevalent as they are today. So from 2.7 billion years ago to the present, we have a rough balance in the sense of the continental land masses are 30% of the surface area of planet Earth, the oceanic crust being 70%. And that those ratios have been stable for the past 2.7 billion years. But previous to 2.7 billion, we have the gradual buildup from zero to about 30%. So 2 weeks ago, we're looking at this, and I said we don't exactly know the precise date of when this continental landmass was building up and reached the present level. Well, thanks to this article that got published. In fact, there's a series of articles in this recent issue of Science that describe, January 24th, but it just hit the newsstands on Friday. It's a little bit different than Nature. The dates are a little stranger. But yeah, if you take a look at it, they have a little article for lay scientists, that means scientists not in the discipline, and then they got an article, a peer-reviewed piece on geophysics, which gets into this. If you want to take a look at it, I'll leave it up here. So, now we can give you numbers as to when this took place. 2.7 billion years ago, we're in day three. Because that's one of the things we'd like to do, is say, well, here are the days of creation. What are the actual dates for these days of creation? Well, 2 weeks ago, I couldn't give you the date for the third creation day, the beginning of the third creation day. Now I can. It's about 2.7 billion years ago. We got the first part of the creation day. The second part would be the production of plants on the land. That would be after 2.7 billion years, and that indeed fits the fossil record. You see ocean-bearing life before that, and then plants begin to show up around 2.5 billion years ago. So now we have a date for the third creation day. Yes. Okay, the land masses were produced by plate tectonics, earthquake activity, and volcanoes. And they were eroded by wind and water. And that's going on to this day. The continents are getting bigger thanks to plate tectonics and volcanism. They're getting smaller thanks to wind and water erosion. And it just depends where you live, whether your property is eroding or building up. We happen to be in an area where it's building up. So there'll be more real estate for us to sell a few million years from now than there is today. California and Hawaii are doing well in that department. Eastern Seaboard is at the other end of the spectrum. They're losing area. So isn't it nice to know that we're in that part of the country where our states are getting bigger and those other states are getting smaller? Maybe we'll get more senators millions of years from now than we do today. We'll see. All right. last thing we need, all right? Yeah, well, I could make a statement about that, but I think I better let that one go, all right? Okay. Fifth creation day. Let the waters teem with living creatures. That's what it says here in this word studies in Genesis 1. In the next edition of this, we're going to give you a few more numbers. What the text is really saying here, if I were to give you a more literal translation from the Hebrew, it's let the water produce swarms of let the waters produce teeming small ocean dwelling creatures. That's really what it's saying here. What we gave you in this word studies in Genesis, I think there's still some here, aren't there? There's some papers there you can pick up over there. If you didn't get one of these. And so the teem is not a verb. It's part of the noun. It's a teeming living creatures. And let the water produce. It's the same word that we see in the third creation day. Remember back in the third creation day, let the land produce plants? This would be let the sea produce these charettes, or teeming creatures. Word in the Hebrew for produce is dasha. The word for the small sea creatures is charettes. Let the water produce. And we run into the same problem we did in the third creation day. That verb dasha could be interpreted that the land produced the plants by natural processes alone. Or it could be interpreted that the land produced the plants by divine creative acts alone, or combination of the two. Likewise here, on this fifth creation day, the beginning of the fifth creation day, you could interpret it that the waters produce these plants by natural processes alone, or the waters produce these, sea creatures by divine creative acts alone, or a combination of the two. So this is another case where the text Rudy has very little to offer on exactly how these plants and sea creatures came about. Here we're dependent on the scientific evidence to tell us what it is. As we discussed in the third creation day, there is evidence for plant speciation by natural process. Not a lot. There's a handful of plant species that biologists have documented have arisen through natural processes from other plant species. But we need to be careful there because the distinctions between species at the plant level are rather small. And really what we might be observing is simply new breeds of plants coming into existence rather than actual independent species, independent in the sense that they can't hybridize with other species. And this is why that, in fact, the text often here talks about them reproducing after their own kind, plants bearing seeds according to their own kinds. And we discuss that most Hebrew scholars prefer interpreting this as a reference to genera rather than to species. And genera being the collection of species that are capable of hybridizing and taking a species from one genus to another genus. It's a not likely you're going to get them hybridizing. So, but with animals and sea animals, the evidence we have for new speciation is virtually non-existent. In fact, I don't know of any oceanic species that has been observed to come into existence through natural processes from other species. A couple of land creatures, maybe, but again, it's more like a new breed than it is a species distinct from any other species in terms of being able to hybridize. Yes, Ted.
Is the small sea animals
that
you're talking about?
Okay, good question. What are these charettes? Okay, they're small. So we're not talking whales. They're small creatures. But we're not talking very primitive life either. They're not super primitive. They're not super advanced. They're in between. Now, if you go elsewhere in the Bible and see, well, that's a good thing to do. Let's look at the word charettes and see where else in the Bible it shows up. What you discover is that word is used for shellfish, for oysters and clams. It would be used for the soft creatures in the oceans, you know, like maybe sea cucumbers, jellyfish, that kind of thing. So And by swarms, it means creatures that reproduce in great numbers. So we're looking at small sea creatures that teem or swarm. Those are capable of massive reproduction, lots of eggs, lots of offspring. And, you know, like we walk on a beach and it's just littered with millions of oysters. Probably not anymore, but when I was a kid, we could visit beaches that were littered with millions of oysters. And those oysters would develop in that state very quickly. I mean, you'd go to a beach that was nothing but sand. You'd come back a few years later, and you can't see the sand because of the oysters stacked on top of one another. So they're capable of reproducing to a terrific rate, given the chance. That's really what this word is all about. Small sea creatures with the capacity of a tremendous reproduction. So is the word ever used for anything bigger than a starfish or a crab? The answer is no. That be about the top end of the charettes. What's the bottom end of the charettes? Well, from the biblical text, we really can't tell. I mean, it might go all the way down to microscopic. We just don't know. So apparently there's no lower end to the size, but there is an upper end to the size. Okay? It's never used to refer to fish or to sea mammals. Never. So the other kinds of creatures. All right. Creatures, by the way, that are factor heavily into limestone production, coral production, etc. You know, there are a lot of islands that are coral islands, so that may be a factor here. All right, the production of small sea animals, and again, I'd make the point that the scientific evidence is telling us that the Dasha is to be interpreted as divine intervention rather than natural process, with very few, if any, exceptions. Now, why can we say that? All right, we'll be getting into this after we get through the 6 days of creation, but we covered it in our scientific evidence for the God of the Bible, that when you look at the fossil record, what we see today is extensive evidence for extinction and virtually no evidence for speciation. But when you look at the fossil record previous to the creation of mankind, we see extensive evidence for both. In the 6 days of creation, we have God creating new species of life to replace those that go extinct. But once you get past the sixth creation day, God goes into a state of rest. He ceases from his work of creating new species of life. Therefore, we can look at what's going on in the realm of biology today to get some feel for how we are to interpret the production of small sea animals. All right, if it's natural process, then we should be able to see it today. If we don't see it today, given the fact that physical conditions were the same back then on the earth, then we'd have to attribute it to divine intervention. And that's something that's not always appreciated in biology, that biology today is operating by different principles, different standards in biology previous to the human species. And this is why the fossil record activity is so different post-human than pre-human. I mean, if you go pre-human, we see that the life, the pattern of life on Earth is to become more diverse, more complex, with more and more species, filling out the ecological niches, whereas since mankind is going exactly the opposite direction. Fewer and fewer species, less and less diversity, with the most complex species suffering the greatest extinction pattern. God's at rest. He's not in the business of replacing those species of life like he was in the past. So this is where we can get some insight as to how to interpret this verse. Okay. Any questions before we move into the... Yes.
Comment. Since he created the upper line,
I wouldn't say it's not priority. What we have taking place here in the text is God is telling us about, in fact, it's just what we're going to be moving into. Up until this point, all the texts address is the creation or the production of life that is physical only. When we move into the second part of the fifth creation day, we'll now be talking about life that's not only physical, but soulish as well as physical. In the sixth creation day, the end of the sixth creation day, it will introduce us to one species only that's physical, soulish, and spiritual. So what the text is telling us here is God made three different kinds of life. Physical life, life that's physical and soulish, and one species that's physical, soulish, and spiritual as well. Now, what that tells us in terms of priority, it hints at the fact that God places a higher value on spirit life than he does on life that's merely soulish, and a higher value on soulish life than he does on life that's merely physical. And this is borne out in the rest of the books of Moses. Once you get into Exodus, particularly Leviticus, you'll see that this priority or valuation of life follows that pattern. That we human beings are to take greater care in protecting birds and mammals, the soulish life, than we are the rest of life on this planet. But all life is valued and to be protected and cherished and managed with wisdom. But what's interesting is what we see in terms of human management is the exact opposite. We've done the most damage to the soulish life, the least damage to life that's not soulish. So, in that sense, we've not followed God's priority. And in light of the abortion crisis we're facing today, we can say, well, gee, we're not even following that compared to the spirit life, soulish life. You know, it's interesting that we got segments of society today who are much more concerned about the preservation of soulish life than they are about the preservation of spirit life. So,
could you use that as an example of evil?
Yes.
That's
one of the evidences of evil, is that things are counter to the natural pattern. And the natural pattern that God had set up was the system of priority of spirit life to soulish life to life that's merely physical. And one of the evidences that we human beings are evil is the fact that we seem to have misplaced our priorities. This is not God's desire. Creation is not going according to God's plan. And God's trying to alert us to the problem so that we can wake up to this. So, all right. Want some sharp warnings in that? Read Isaiah 24. God warns us of the consequences of man's rebellion as we come into the last days before the return of Christ. So what we see taking place today is predicted to become much worse in that context. All right. Any comments from this side of the class? I've been kind of focusing my attention over there. All right. Yes.
God knew what was coming. He should have known that some of the man why did he knowing that?
Okay, good question. Given the state of affairs today, and given the doctrine of God's foreknowledge, why did God let us human beings get so out of control? Well, maybe I could ask that same question of various parents in the classroom. Why do you let your kids get so out of control, all right? You could ask that question to me. I've been guilty of that, right? Why do we do it? There is some benefit into letting them get a little bit out of control. We all of us who are parents have exercised that privilege. There's certain lessons that children learn through a little bit. And that's what God is doing. He's giving humanity a little bit of rope. And we tug on that rope and we experience some of the consequences of that. And hopefully we're going to learn a lesson from this that will benefit us in the creation to come. That's really what's going on. Now what we do see in places like Isaiah 24 is that the rope has a finite length. There's going to come a time when God's going to tug it up short. I mean, those of you who own dogs, isn't that how you train dogs, right? You give them a little leash there, these little choke things, and the dog goes charging off, and suddenly he gets pulled up short. And he learns certain things by that. So, I don't know. Use whatever analogy you want. Maybe come up with a better analogy. All right, moving into the latter part of the fifth creation day. Let the waters teem with living creatures. And so we have this production of creatures in the sea. And let birds fly above the earth and across the expanse of the sky. So this is the first mention of birds. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing that moves and every living and moving thing with which the water teems, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. Okay, a little bit gets lost in the translation here. Let the waters teem with living creatures. We've seen that one. Let the birds fly above the earth and across the expanse of the sky. So birds are going to be given access to the whole of the expanse of the sky. This includes both the sky above the oceans, the sky above the continents, and every living and moving thing. Okay, there it introduces this word nephesh. So in the original Hebrew language, it was crystal clear what God was claiming here. It doesn't come across so clear to English. Say, well, it's something that's alive. Whereas in the Hebrew, it's very specific. It's referring to the nephesh, the soulish creatures. So this is the first time the text mentions birds. It's the first time it mentions mammals. Okay? The nephesh creatures are creatures endowed by God with mind, will, and emotions so that they can form relationships with human beings, meaningful relationships with human beings. These are the soulish creatures. They do not have the capacity to form a relationship with God, but they have the capacity to form relationships with human beings. Now, a good question to ask is, well, why would God bother before human beings exist? All right? Because this is what happens. Before Adam and Eve even show up, we have God creating birds and mammals with the capacity to form relationships with human beings. You might even go so far as to say with a desire to form relationships with human beings. This is one thing we notice biologically about birds and mammals. Not only do they have that capacity, they seem to have that desire. They want to form relationships with us. Well, that desire couldn't be expressed until Adam and Eve showed up on the scene. But then, you know, why did God do it this way? Well, again, you can look at it from an ecological perspective. It's going to take some preparation, some time ecologically to have these creatures develop and fit and multiply so that when mankind shows up on the scene, mankind would be ready to relate to these creatures in a way that would be successful and helpful for supporting his economy. You just produce them all at once. It's going to take some time before those relationships can develop and the economy can be exploited to the degree that God intended would be possible. Yes. Ah, reptiles. I got bad news for you. This text does not address reptiles. They're mentioned nowhere here in the text. Amphibians are mentioned nowhere in the text. The fish are not mentioned anywhere in the text. Insects are not mentioned anywhere in the text. So this could be very disturbing to a 20th century biologist. He looks at this chapter and says, whole phyla are dropped from mention. It's not just the lack of dinosaurs. Reptiles, period, aren't mentioned. Amphibians aren't mentioned. These are very important sectors of life here on Earth, but they're dropped. All right. Now, the Christian response to this is to say, well, what do you expect? It's condensed to one page. I mean, if you were trying to write a story of what God did to prepare the earth for human beings, and you're restricted to just one page, would you bother to spend a lot of time talking about reptiles, amphibians, and insects? Probably not. And that's kind of where Moses is coming from. He says it's much more important to talk about these birds and mammals than it is to talk about amphibians and reptiles.
Chapter 3, we know that there were reptiles.
In chapter 3, we know you got a joke coming. What's coming up here? No?
Well, isn't that the fall? Isn't that where the serpent is?
You got a serpent there. All right.
Okay.
All right. But we're going to talk about what that serpent's all about. All right? Because that's a speculation point. Is it a real snake or is it not? All right. We're going to get to that. The creeping things are not cockroaches. All right? That's a good point. I mean, that issue comes up frequently when I address this on university campuses. They say, we know Genesis is a pile of nonsense. Because it talks about these creeping things in the sixth creation day, just before the creation of Adam and Eve. And the fossil record is replete with proof that insects show up early in the fossil record, back to the Cambrian explosion. So how can anyone give any scientific credence to this book? My response is, who says the creeping things of the sixth creation day are insects? And when we get there, we probably won't get there until next week because my time is out of time. But when you get to that sixth creation day, what you're going to notice is that the creeping things are a subset of the nephesh creatures. They can't be insects. They must be mammals. So what are they? They're short-legged mammals. And really the way the King James translated this is a bit unfortunate. I mean, if you were living in Elizabethan times, it probably wouldn't be confusing, but it certainly is to 20th century readers of the King James Bible. And what it's really talking about is these land mammals with four legs that are built close to the ground. Okay, so rats, mice, they're built close to the ground. What are these creatures that wander around at night? Opossums, all right? They're built close to the ground. Rabbits, they're built close. Weasels, okay. I mean, you get the idea. And it's contrasting those land mammals with the long-legged quadrupeds. In fact, I've often done this when I've taught on this, is to, rather than use the words that are in the English translation, look at the three original Hebrew words. And the three original Hebrew words are talking about four-legged land mammals that have short legs, long-legged land mammals that are easy to tame, and long-legged land mammals that are difficult to tame. These are the three kinds of land mammals that are discussed. Now, the other apologetic thing that comes out of here, people look at this and say, wait a minute. The fossil record says land mammals predate ocean mammals. And this text puts ocean mammals in the fifth creation day and land mammals on the sixth creation day. Therefore, why should I pay any attention to this book? This book can't possibly be true. What they're failing to recognize is that the land mammals of the sixth creation day are three specialized kinds of land mammals. It's not referring to land mammals generic. On the fifth creation day, you can claim, okay, it's talking about birds generically and ocean mammals generically. But the sixth creation day is not speaking of land mammals generically. It doesn't use the word nephesh. It uses three different Hebrew words to describe specialized kinds of land mammals. And how we're to really interpret the text, these are three different kinds of land mammals that God specially created to cohabit with humanity. Because it's the same text that mentions human beings. God creates these three specialized kinds of land mammals, then he creates human beings. What are these land mammals all about? Well, these are the ones that you're going to be relating most commonly with. Not that you'll never have a relationship with a whale, but from the standpoint of Adam and Eve and their descendants, the first creatures that they really began to relate significantly to were these three specialized kinds of land mammals. Now, how does that fit with the fossil record? Perfectly. It's a perfect fit with the fossil record. Thank you. Let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had today getting into this text and what more we have to look forward to. We're grateful for that. Help us to use our study here to communicate to people that this really is a message that's coming from the creator of the universe himself, a message from the King, a message that we need to pay attention to, a message that can give us new life and new hope. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.